What does it mean to be alive? How does the life of a pine tree differ from the life of a puppy, differ from the life of a person? To attain any assured knowledge about the soul, said Aristotle, is one of the most difficult things in the world. This is Dr. Jim Tomkiewicz, Director of Distance Learning at Wyoming Catholic College, and you're listening to the After Dinner Scholar, the college's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. Regardless of whether attaining any assured knowledge about the soul is one of the most difficult things in the world, Aristotle charged right in. His book, De Anima, On the Soul, explores the question of what it means to be alive. What is it that we possess through life, but lose in death? Wyoming Catholic College philosophy professor, Dr. Michael Bolin, specializes in the work of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, who was, of course, an Aristotelian. Dr. Bolin is currently teaching De Anima to Wyoming Catholic College sophomores. Dr. Bolin, it seems to me that today there are at least three common and, I think, perennial errors about the soul, and that Aristotle can help us with each one. The first is sort of a fideistic error. The only reason I believe that I have a soul is because the Bible and the Church tell me so. The second is what we might call scientific reductionism. We've done MRIs, we've done CAT scans, we've done brain surgery. We can't find the soul, so we know that man is mechanistic, and that's all we know. And then the third is more of a Gnostic or Eastern approach that says the soul is everything. The physical is really not all that important and not really me and maybe even in question. Can you take those one at a time, beginning with, I just accept it on faith? Aristotle didn't accept the soul on faith, did he?
No, he didn't. Of course, the ancient philosophers, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, predated Christ. They don't have the New Testament or Revelation to work with. And so they're using natural reason to see what they can say about the soul and life. I would say there's a connection between the first two questions, the fideistic view and the reductionist view, and I'll get to the second one second, but there's this idea that both of them, as we'll see, depend on a misconception of what the soul is. So for the sort of naive view that we might start off with as children, is the soul is a spiritual, it's a ghost within us, the glowing halo or something like that. And since we don't see anything like that, it's hard to believe in it. But if I'm a person of faith, I have to believe in it because of the sources of revelation, and so I do. And then it feels like, yeah, the only reason I have for believing it is revelation. But that stems from a misconception of what soul is. If we go back perhaps to the etymology of the word, it originally means something like breath. The Latin word anima refers to breath, and it also comes to mean soul. So
the Greek word psuche is the same way, and the Hebrew word that I can't remember off the top of my head is the same thing.
Right. So there's this idea that breath and soul are somehow the same. And why is that? Well, because in its beginnings, the idea was soul is whatever makes things alive. What's one of the first things we see about living creatures? The animals around us, ourselves, we breathe. When a person dies, they stop breathing. The soul, the breath is gone. Right. And so if we take that generically, we just say the soul is whatever makes things alive, then we can see that, well, we don't need revelation to get that far to see that there is a principle of life. We just need to notice that there are non-living things and there are living things. There are different activities that pertain to each of them. So living things grow, they reproduce, they sense if they're animals, they have sight and hearing and so forth. And we human beings have all that. And we have intellects as well. We think and reason. So those are the sort of the activities of life, the most basic ones being common to all life: growth, reproduction, nutrition. And so for the ancients, for Plato and Aristotle, the soul is whatever makes living things to be the kind of things that grow and reproduce. And since we know they have those activities, we know that from our senses, we see them, we have our own sensation. We know that there must be a principle for those activities. And that's before we ever get to the point of revelation. I can't right now walk through the whole argument of Aristotle's treatment of the soul, but that's where it starts. We observe there are living things with various activities. We say, soul is whatever gives in those activities. And then we try to investigate, what is that principle that conveys those activities? But we don't need a revelation to get that far. We just have our common sense and our reason.
Well, let's move on to scientific reductionism. Michael Argres of Thomas Aquinas College writes in his new book, the immortal in you, how human nature is more than science can say, quote, the error of this position is the assumption that if you were somehow exceptional, if there were something immortal or spiritual about you, then modern biology would tell us all about it. How does Aristotle address those who see life purely in mechanistic terms?
I guess my first comment would be to say, we should notice that what I've just been saying in answer to the previous question, distinguishing the activities of life from non-life, that doesn't by itself tell us that the soul is some kind of spiritual substance. It's just saying there's a principle for these activities. And the modern materialist conception says, sure, there is a principle. It's a material principle. It's the brain, the biology, the cells. And so the activities can be explained in material terms. In particular, the argument that's usually given is that we can't find any activity in living things that is not caused by a physical source, has a physiological cause. So sure, we see sensation in thinking, but if you are able to observe the brain well enough, you will see there are physical correlates to every act of thinking and sensation. There's neural activity going on in the brain. And so the materialist reductionist view says that activity is just what sensation is, what thought is. There's nothing more to it. And the argument would continue, if there were this purported soul, this somehow immaterial principle, what role is left for it? What is it supposed to do? Since we see matter engaged in the neurons of the brain and so forth, engaged in all these activities, does the soul somehow push or pull on the matter to make it do something different? Well, we don't see any matter in living things that behaves differently from, it follows the same rules that all physical matter follows. And so what's left for soul to do? How does it interact with the body? That's sort of the argument, I guess. And as I suggested in reference to the previous question, I think that that line of thinking stems from a misconception of what soul is. So starting with the French philosopher Descartes, Descartes sort of presents the soul as the real me. I'm my soul and I sort of inhabit this body like a pilot in a ship, an image that shows up as far back as Plato, but Descartes really makes it a thing. So there's this notion after him in both camps that the soul is this independent substance, the real person, allegedly, that inhabits a body. And if you were thinking about it in that way, then I think the moderns have a point. We can't seem to find a sign that there's a ghost inhabiting the machine, pushing the levers, pulling the levers. The problem is that that's actually not the kind of thing that soul is supposed to be, that it is. It's not an independent substance. So Aristotle says in his book on the soul, asking whether body and soul are one thing or two things would be like asking whether the wax, a lump of wax, and the shape of the lump of wax are one thing or two things. And with that analogy, we can see typically nobody thinks of the shape of a thing as an independent entity from the thing itself. Rather, shape and matter are two principles that come together to make one thing, a lump of wax. And Aristotle says the soul is sort of like the shape of the lump of the wax. It's not an independent entity, an independent being, but it's a principle of a being that comes together with matter to make one human being. And so when we see activities like sensation or thought going on, it's not the soul doing them in the body or the body doing them with the soul helping, but it's a person, an animal doing those things, and they're able to do them because they're the kind of thing that has that power. So the soul makes them to be that kind of thing. It doesn't sort of do the activity itself, but the creature, the human being, the horse, whatever it is, performs those. There's a, actually, he's a science fiction author, Michael Flynn, who's also a Thomist, likes to talk about this. He sort of pokes fun at the moderns' problem. The moderns talk about the interaction problem, the mind-body problem. How do the mind and the body interact? That's the problem I was describing earlier. Mm-hmm. And he says, sort of poking fun at this, he says, well, why don't we talk about the sphere basketball problem? How does sphericity, the shape of the basketball, interact with the leather to make it behave in certain ways? And he's drawing on Aristotle's analogy of soul being analogous to shape. And of course, the answer is, well, sphericity, the spherical shape, it doesn't push or pull on leather, but it makes it a ball. And because it's a ball, it does the sorts of things that balls do. It rolls, for example. Similarly, soul doesn't push and pull on the matter, but it makes the matter to be living matter. And then we see living matter do all the things that the scientists are observing on their MRIs or whatnot. So it really comes down to a misconception in what the soul is. we shouldn't think of it as a ghost in the machine. It's not a being exactly, but a principle of being. Just like you don't find physical matter without a shape. It's always shaped. You have the stuff and what makes it to be a certain kind of thing, like a basketball. And similarly, soul is what makes matter to be a horse or a human being or whatever the living thing is. It doesn't act like a ghost.
Yeah, well, I thought that was interesting in Aristotle that he specifically says you can't have a soul without a body. And that's certainly all over the culture, even all over the church, that notion that somehow our bodies are a cage that is holding our soul, and the soul is the true self, as you said, Descartes talked about. Now, Aristotle also not only derives the notion of soul from natural reasoning, but he also talks about the immortality of the soul. How does he get there?
Okay, that's a good question, yes. As again, he doesn't have revelation, so how would he know about an afterlife? And I'll say he's not very committal about it. He's not convinced very strongly, I think, and he couldn't be. But he does see a hint of it. He says early on in the book that the question whether the soul is immortal is one of the big questions people have about soul. Is there an afterlife? Could soul live on? And he says, well, that comes down to this question. Asking whether soul could be immortal comes down to asking, is there some kind of activity of the soul that's not intrinsically, essentially dependent on matter? And he ends up saying, yes, I think there is in human beings. It's intellect, it's thought, the operation of mind. Whereas growth, obviously, is an activity of life, but you can't grow if you don't have a body, right? So growth is essentially an activity of matter. Similarly, sensation requires sense organs. And so sensation, sight, wouldn't make any sense without an organ of sight. And so the functions common to plants and to other animals, growth, nutrition, sensation, are essentially bodily. And so the principle of life that carries out those activities couldn't exist apart from matter. But thought, he argues, is not essentially a material activity. The universal concepts that we human beings form in thinking, notions like triangle, not some image of a specific triangle, but the generic concept, seems somehow independent of matter. There's a reason for that. It's a little bit complicated to go into now, but the essence is that he says what's in the intellect, universal thoughts, has to exist apart from matter. And that means that at least that function of life, intellection, is somehow independent of matter. And so there's no intrinsic reason why it couldn't continue even when the soul is no longer forming the body, making it alive. And so he takes that to be the sign that, yes, maybe there's an afterlife for human beings. The human soul is possibly immortal. But he can't say much more than that without revelation.
It seems to me that Thomas would want to say more than that. St. Thomas would want to say more than that. Does Thomas expand that?
He develops the arguments there, but when he does go on to say more, he is drawing upon revelation. It seems to me that has to be the case, right? Aristotle has no idea what the afterlife is like. Thomas thinks he has some idea, but only because of revelation. That there is an afterlife, that the soul lives on, reason can see by its own lights apart from revelation. But to really know anything about the nature of that life is dependent on revelation. So I guess that would be the point where the original view we were talking about, the fideistic view, that would be where it converges into the Thomistic view.
Well, and even in the fideistic view, St. Paul says, well, what's our life with God going to be like? And he says, what a resurrected body is going to be like. And he says, well, I have no idea, really, but right. It's going to be great.
Right. So.
Well, thank you very much.
No problem. My pleasure.
The question of what it means to be alive, to have a soul in Aristotle's language, is not simply a matter of philosophical speculation. The definition of to be alive is central to debates over abortion and euthanasia. The way we understand the human body and the human soul informs what we think about sexuality and marriage. The question is all around us. As Michael Augrus writes in his book, The Immortal in You, philosophy is like thinking and breathing, not something that we can either do or not do if we like, but what we must do, and must do either badly or well, so long as we live. We are, all of us, philosophers, willy-nilly, close quote. If you've enjoyed these conversations and you'd like to become a better philosopher, let me encourage you to join us here in Lander this coming June for the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought. It's a week for adults to sit and think and read and become better at this work of philosophy that we all do quite naturally. Visit the Wyoming Catholic website, wyomingcatholic.org, for more information. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.